Folks, when the day-to-day becomes too flavorless for our taste, we reach for the spice rack. This reaching for interest leads us to ask, how have spices spiced up history?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 965th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Larnaca who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Aaron, hello there.
Good morning.
Now, Aaron, what is your favorite spice?
Cinnamon.
Cinnamon. Fair enough. Also with us today, producer Anna Ringelman. Anna, what's your favorite spice?
My favorite spice is cinnamon as well.
Cinnamon is two cinnamons. Producer Kristen Carlson, how about you? What's your favorite?
Well, my family is known for their Swedish coffee bread, so I'm going to have to say cardamom.
Cardamom. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, folks, do you suppose there's any stories behind cinnamon and cardamom? I bet there is. You know, like many, if not most, I came to take spices for granted. Why? Well, whenever my food needed a lift, I simply reached for the spice rack. When something is always there, and a spice rack of one kind or another was always there, you kind of come to take it for granted. Then one day, some years back, I hosted a Food Chain radio show from the Salinas Valley Prison in Soledad, California. This prison featured an inmate horticulture program in which some of the inmates planted and tended ornamental plants around the prison grounds. What immediately captured my attention as I toured the grounds with an assistant warden was the difference in countenance between the prisoners who worked with plants and those who did not. Inmates that worked the ornamental plants had a certain peacefulness about them, which, given their surroundings, was most pronounced. Those who did not work with plants appeared anxious and irritable, as if ready to explode into flight or fight. Noting the difference in countenance, I asked the warden why the inmates were growing only ornamentals and not edibles, something to liven up their food and make everybody happy, maybe. He replied, "If we allowed one group of inmates to grow chili peppers, and that this group had them and the other group didn't, we would soon have a full-scale war on our hands." And thus, I was reintroduced to the value of spices. In thinking about that conversation, today I just have to ask, how have spices spiced up history? And who better to ask than Gary Napan, who is the author of Cummins, Camels, and Caravan, also the professor of sustainable agriculture systems at the University of Arizona. Gary, welcome to the Food Chain.
Great to be with you again, Michael, and what a wonderful introduction to the importance of spices.
Well, it sure struck me when I was talking with that warden of how important they were, because I just got to thinking about the dullness and drabness of prison food, institutional food, and what, you know, a little jalapeno pepper might do for that food. And then you come to realize that spices really are an important part of our lives. And, you know, in picking up your book and opening up and falling in love with it, I come to realize that you are kind of a desert person and probably are most at home down there in Arizona, are you not?
That's right. I live 20 miles north of the border. I've been a desert ecologist for 35 years in the Sonoran Desert that includes Baja California and Sonora, Mexico. But I've also gone to the Gobi, Taklamakan, Arabian Peninsula, Sahara, and other deserts tracking spice traders, because my own family was spice traders.
That's right. Going way, way, way back, right?
That's correct.
Well, and speaking of spices, there are so many of them to consider, and so today I thought we would pick up one, and that's the one that you say stands alone, frankincense. And I think the reason I'd like to pick up this is a photograph I picked up in your book, Coming Camels and Caravans, of a single gnarly tree standing up by itself in a desert with nothing else growing as far as the eye can see. And that was a frankincense tree. And I thought, there's something about that tree. There has to be something about that tree. And then, of course, there is the story that many of us have heard growing up about the three wise men, or some say three kings, that came from the east bearing gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the baby Jesus. I always wondered about that story, you know, why three wise men would be hauling frankincense and myrrh around. What the heck is that? And then in Coming Camels and Caravans, I learned that that frankincense stuff is really the foundation upon almost a civilization, right?
That's right. It was one of the first plant products that was ever in transcontinental trade. And what I mean by that is that it left the Arabian Peninsula for Africa, for Asia, and for Europe more than 3,500 years ago. And it became the most highly valued product in the world for centuries.
And there it is. So when we hear that story about the baby Jesus, we think, well, maybe there's something very interesting here. And it certainly is an interesting story once you start digging into it. Frankincense, is that where we get the word incense?
I think it's, in a sense, the reverse, that incenses were called various things in various languages, but it was one of the ones that was traded up to the Franks. It's not called frankincense in the area where it's planted. In fact, it's called milk of the gods or food of the gods. And it's a rather milky resin like we might see from milkweed, but this resin dries up into these gorgeous crystalline droplets that are shaped like tears. And again, by Roman times, its price per volume was the most important thing, the most expensive thing in the world. And there were 3,000 tons of frankincense carried on trade routes up to Babylon and to Rome and to Athens well before the three magi. Carried it, if there were just three magi.
So who knows? Well, take us to the growing grounds and describe this frankincense tree. Let's start there, because it really is a tree crop that we're talking about. And how the heck do you get the frankincense, and where do these things grow? Let's start with where they grow, because that's really fascinating stuff.
Well, frankincense is one of several plants and exude an incense when their bark is wounded by winds or by the cutting with a knife or by the sweeping of other branches in the high deserts of Oman and Yemen. And so it's at the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula in an area that wasn't called Arabian Deserta, but Arabian Felix, or the happy or content or joyful part of the desert. And frankincense was used spiritually, medicinally, in a culinary manner for millennia in the Arabian Peninsula. And people managed this wild plant. It was not cultivated, but people protected and guarded, said prayers for the plants, abstained from sex and certain foods during the harvest of the plant. So it was a very ritualized collection. And very soon, the people that managed these stands up in what is called the Dhofar Highlands in Oman, where I visited them, became very, very wealthy and protective and secretive about the gathering grounds that they themselves had usufruct rights or temporary ownership over.
So frankincense goes way back then, way before Christianity, way before any of the established religions were established then. It was way back.
And I think the interesting thing is that it's part of a larger pattern, that the first spices that we know that traveled long distances were in the homelands of some of the poorest people in the world in terms of the productivity and yield of the natural resources.
Okay, that's something I'd like to very much pick up when we come back. Why is it that some of the most precious things come from the baddest places? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Gary Nabhan and you right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, folks, I'm looking at a picture of a frankincense tree in Common Camels and Caravans by Gary Nabhan. And the photograph shows a real gnarled tree standing up against, it's about four times as tall as a human being. There's a picture of a human being next to it. But in the background, there's nothing. It's just the empty nothingness. Nothing else is living there. And how is it that something so precious as frankincense, which was the most precious thing of all in those days, how does it come from such a harsh, unforgiving, unyielding environment? What happened? How does that work, Gary Nabhan?
Well, every habitat in the world, from the Arctic Circle down through the driest desert, has products from plants that are rich in certain chemicals, potent chemicals. And in arid lands, some of those plants that are very scarce, and that may be one reason why they're so valuable, have extremely potent chemicals that are used, as I said, as medicines, as vermifuges to get rid of bed bugs and body lice and things like that. They're used to get us out of our workaday moods and into a more transcendent attitude and spirit. And so the people in the driest lands did not have productive staple foods, but they had transportable quantities of small but very valuable and potent gums and oils and herbs that could break up the redundancy among the people that produced thousands and thousands of tons of wheat or of millet or of rice, but had that wheat or millet or rice day after day. And what the key element was is that these people from desert areas that traded frankincense and myrrh and other valuable spices were not just trading highly potent chemical product, but they were trading stories and legends and myths that went along with it. They were the exotic. They were the other. And they were to surprise, delight, and break up the monotony among people in better watered climes.
And there's also something about the fact that those people who lived in better watered climates didn't smell so good either, right?
That's right. Frankincense and many of the oils and certainly even many herbs were used not just as deodorants, but before a couple went into a bout of lovemaking on their honeymoon night, they would often be prepared by sisters or brothers so that they were coated in these incredible fragrances because their own capacity to bathe daily or even weekly was limited. And so some people say that spices not only disguised the odors of people, but of partially spoiled or fermented foods that had very potent disagreeable odors.
And but there was also something very special about frankincense, and that specialness was the fact that it had a very spiritual element. Was it not where we got the expression holy smokes?
That's right. It was called the food of the gods, it literally was the embodiment of the spirit. People could light this little tear-like droplet of frankincense gum, and the smoke would rise straight up toward the heavens, and so it was a way to communicate with the heavens, to show your presence, and it had such an overpowering effect on the fragrance in an entire room that it was sort of a palpable reminder that there was more than just the visible world that we're engaged with. So after the first smoke of frankincense, you might not see anything visible, but for another hour or two, you could smell and take deeply into your lungs this extraordinary fragrance. And the same thing is true with musk from musk deer in the Himalayas and in the Tian Shan Mountains in Mongolia. A tiny bit of musk was enough to mix in with the mortar of that was used to plaster a mosque or a temple. And years later, when it would rain hard, people could smell that musk again from the walls of their holy places.
And I understand that musk is very valuable to this day. So what, $42,000 a kilogram or something?
That's right. It may be the most expensive fragrance today, but it's also because musk deer have been overexploited throughout Asia and now must be managed like reindeer to survive because the black market demand for musk is so great that poaching goes on even in the most remote mountain ranges of Asia.
Well, that takes us back to the frankincense tree then. And the thought is, you know, here's a tree that produces some extremely valuable sap. How on earth did the people way back then manage these trees without, you know, oh my goodness, let's go. The way you get the sap is that you take a knife and you score the trunk, right?
That's right. And so it must be scored several times. This is true with other gums like gum tragacanth. So you take a specially shaped knife, you make a vertical incision along the bark of the trunk, and then you come back within the next 2 weeks and harvest it, almost like people harvest maple sugar from sugar bushes. And the key thing is that they may have had laborers that worked beyond the family that owned the gathering grounds, but they would not let any trader come to the gathering grounds. It was secret. In fact, incredible myths were promulgated that reached there were flying snakes and dragon-like animals that protected the grounds of frankincense, so no one would go near them or try to go near them. And so again, the value was its mythic value, not just the value of its calories or its chemicals. It went far beyond that because when something comes to you from 2,000 or 3,000 miles away, you're wanting to know about the adventure that brought it to you from this exotic place, not just how many grams of the product that you get.
Right. Got to have a good story, which we're going to pick up when we talk about the frankincense trail. But I'd like to go back and how did they maintain the grounds, the the frankincense trees. What kind of ethic was involved in maintaining these trees? I mean, it seems like if it was so valuable, you'd have everybody sneaking in and chopping up the trees to get the sap.
Well, there were caretakers, and it was a hereditary stewardship of these stands, and they're up in the mountains and canyons and very difficult to get through in an area of very low population. So there would be protectors put out in that place, and again, these sort of mythic protectors like the flying snakes. But then they would make sure that every harvester was trained not to overcap the resources of the sap and keep it alive. And it's only been within the last 50 years as the Omanis have grown wealthy from the oil business that they've hired Somalis and other people who now, some say, are less precise in the way they harvest them. That's not true of all Somalis, certainly, because some have been working for several generations for the Omani and Yemeni people. But there was strict taboos on when you could not harvest and how much you could harvest from each tree so that you wouldn't kill the tree.
So, you know, it sounds not unlike what goes on in the cannabis grounds of Northern California, where you have people watching over things and whatnot, and alligators guarding the pot patches and lions and stuff like that. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking a little bit about how spices spice up history. In particular, we're looking at frankincense, the herb that stands above all herbs. Right back. Well, it's a long ways off there in Oman, where these frankincense trees grow and where they're harvested by scoring with knives and collecting the sap. And the sap is frankincense, and it is one of the most precious spices in the world, used as an aromatic, used as all kinds of things. When you look at frankincense, you Google it and look up all of the uses for it. It's like an encyclopedia of uses. Why is that so, Gary Nabhan?
Well, I think there's two parts of that. This was a product that first exemplified the processes that we now associate with globalization, of bringing something from an exotic land and having the status of being able to say in Rome or Athens, I have this incredible product that was brought 4,000 miles by camel. And so people then began to innovate on how to use it. And the culinary innovations go on today. There's medicinal products that, in fact, I use for an injured back that are made from frankincense oils and ingested or topically applied. And so once you've achieved the status of being able to bargain for a product, and Julius Caesar actually worried that people were wasting too much of their economic wealth on frankincense and other aromatics. But once you gain that status, you want to flaunt it, and you want to have ceremonies and feasts and gatherings where this product and the innovations that you've made takes it to a new level of societal respect and gives you a reputation of being a person of status and innovation. And so why I'm even looking at spices and gums like frankincense is to say that every single stage of globalization was anticipated by spice traders going back 3,500 years ago. Globalization didn't start with the discovery of the Americas by Columbus or the transcontinental voyages of Magellan or Zheng Ye, the Chinese navigator. It really began with these spice traders in some of the most remote and impoverished parts of the world.
So given that, just a quick parenthetical that I thought of when I was considering that notion of yours, is that how in the world did anybody think the world was flat as late as the 1400s, when there was so much running around going on?
Well, I think that's a myth, too. I mean, I just doubt whether that European notion was shared by many people. I think it's overrated, just like there's the sense that the known world today is the only possible habitable places in the universe. So, right. so it's a distinctly European notion. Other navigators from other continents weren't doing our same kind of maps. They were doing song maps, and they knew about the curvature of the Earth.
Sure.
They came, these Arab spice traders, the seafaring spice traders, were the people that gave us trigonometry and navigation and all of that. So many other skill sets that humans now attribute to Western civilization came out of these seafaring and caravanning spice traders.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the development of the spice trade. And it really did start with those folks way up in the hills there in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, Oman, Yemen, whatnot. But that's a long way, or it certainly was then, from there to the civilized moneyed centers of the world, Rome, whatnot. How did it get the spices to market? You made one comment in there that really captured my attention because it's so true today. The idea was always to keep the producers and the consumers as far apart from each other as possible.
That's right, and there was certainly extra local trade going on in Africa at the same time, and in Asia, spices being traded from Tibet down into the Gobi Desert and along the what later became the Silk Roads. But what the Arabs had and what people in Central Asia had was the great diesel freighters of their time, the camels, the Bactrian camel and the dromedary, allowed these people to carry hundreds of pounds, maybe four or five times the volume and weight that a horse could carry on a camel across extraordinarily desolate spaces. And so the camel was is not in the title of this book incidentally. Cumin is in there because it reached every cuisine very early on. But camels made this possible as almost in a symbiotic relationship with spice traders.
And, of course, caravans.
That's right. So it was not simply that people would go out willy-nilly, but they would follow certain routes with their caravans, 40 to 150 camels. And then there grew up a culture around these caravanserai that are famous in the poems of Rumi and other great Islamic poets, the Sufi poets, about the caravanserai really being the great places of cultural exchange for centuries and centuries, where music styles diffused and culinary traditions diffused and great stories like 1001 Arabian Nights were told. And so the caravanserai were the equivalent of the internet chat site where people could exchange information. You sat down together, you had tea, you burned incenses, and you told stories from other lands. And so that's where cross-cultural exchanges really happened for millennia, not just for a few hundred years.
And it was a place where often you didn't even have the same languages, right?
Well, the spice traders also became such innovators because they were polyglots. They learned many languages. I ran into a spice trader on the in Afghanistan during my travel on the Silk Road. That when I asked him the name of a particular spice, he said, "Well, in what language? I know its name in 12 languages." And I said, "Well, how did you learn that?" And he said, "As an apprentice, to become a spice trader at this hub between the trails coming up from India and the trails coming across from China, I had to apprentice in the spice gathering grounds to know what it was named there and at each of the distribution points along the way. So I had to become conversant with people in 8 or 10 languages. So these were extraordinary people. It was not just that they were clerks or simply brokers, they had extraordinary traditional knowledge, extraordinary linguistic capabilities, and that's why spice traders played a disproportionately large role in this process of globalization. At one point, a Sephardic Jewish or Islamic spice trader in Spain could write a check that would be honored in China 8 months later.
Wow.
And so they had extraordinary networks, and they knew the names and the places all across that trade route from sea to shining sea.
Right back, folks. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Gary Paul Nabhan. Coming, camels, caravans, and the spice trade, and you. Do stay tuned. Well, I don't know about you, but I would love to be at one of those desert oases and sitting around with a bunch of camel-clad people smelling like old camels and the smell of frankincense heavy in the air and tea on the fire and lots of good stories. And it was really a lot about stories, wasn't it, Gary?
Yes, as you painted that picture for me, I thought of my favorite tea, one of the Pu'er teas that is called a camel's breath tea, but it's really camel sweat, that these little hockey puck kind of packed dried tea leaves were strung like beads on a string and put around the camel's neck or around the saddlebags, and they actually absorbed the sweat of the camel, which certain connoisseurs of tea said created the most aromatic and special teas. So while some people may recoil at the notion of camel sweat in these caravanserai, it was part of the magic and part of the odoriferous wonders of this world.
Kind of an acquired taste, probably.
Well, we could say that about stinky cheese as well.
and it really was the stories, though, and the transmitting of stories and the exoticness of being able to buy something that came from someplace so far away.
Well,
that made what was in frankincense much more than what was in frankincense.
Well, just think about the fact that we're still reading in new translations of 1001 Arabian Nights centuries after it was first written down. And it's a mix of Persian and Arabic and other stories that had been orally transmitted for centuries. And yet many of those stories are about spice traders. And, in fact, my own family shows up in three different stories, and they're kind of portrayed by the Persian and the wealthy Arab spice traders of the north that gathered in places like Baghdad is the way New Yorkers might look at wealthy Texas oilmen, sort of as nouveau riche that came up looking for conspicuous items and also for good-looking women, and they were rebuffed by the more sophisticated Persian Baghdad.
Wow. In those times, you talk a little bit about how the Jewish people and the Muslim people actually seemed to get along in the world of spice trading. Was there such a time in the world?
That's right, and it was most of the time in the world that Arab and Jewish peoples, Semitic peoples, they were all Semitic peoples, shared many of
What do you mean by Semitic?
From the Semitic language family that included the Phoenicians, the Nabataeans, and many other people, Aramaic and Syriac languages that were spread across the New World and were, for many centuries, the lingua franca, Aramaic in particular, in trade. And so what I'm saying is that Jewish and Arab peoples are more alike and collaborated together for longer than the period that they've been in conflict. And that was the underlying drive for me writing this book. The Sephardic Jewish traders, including the Radonite Jews, continued on into the medieval area in Europe as some of the most prominent spice traders and the highest cuisines, I think, that the world has ever known are things like the Moroccan cuisines of Fez. It clearly had Sephardic Jewish and Arab and Persian, as well as Berber influences. So the Jewish traders and Arab traders collaborated more than they conflicted with one another. They were sometimes competitors, of course, but the whole idea that they were, sort of genetically at odds with one another, or culturally at odds, is not borne out by history, that for more time than there were conflicts, they were on the same ships crossing the Indian Ocean. They were on the same caravans together, and they shared evenings with one another in the caravanserai. And that was the moral reason for writing this book, to wake Americans and Western Europeans up to the fact that these people not only collaborated, but they suffered from the same Holocaust, like the Spanish Inquisition. That was not just Jewish people or not just Muslim people expelled from the Iberian Peninsula. They were both expelled from at the same time through the same xenophobia of northern Spanish Christians at that moment.
You know, it seems like when you're crossing the desert with a caravan of camels carrying very expensive, very portable products like spices, which were very, I mean, it wasn't like you're hauling scrap iron across the desert. You've got light stuff, right?
You're right.
It would seem like you would be put upon by those who would want to steal your goods and your goods.
Well, you're correct. So the caravanserai were really fortresses where the camels were on the lower floor and the apartments with not gun turrets, but windows through which people could fire it at raiders could shield them, but put them in a defensible position. But some of the spice trading cultures, like the Nabataeans at Petra, in fact, began as pirates in the Red Sea and as marauders or bandits out from the ports. And gradually they captured the spice trade routes. And
there they are. Going to have to take a quick break, Gary. But when we come back, I'd like to ask you the big question. What can we learn from the spice trades and as we go forward into the world? Did what we learned then have any lessons for us today? Do stay tuned, right back. As I understand it, Gary, they were pirates, and then they were spice traders, and then they were kind of like the merchants of the Frankincense Trail, and then they became farmers. Very interesting people.
They were. Many people have been had their imaginations captured by Petra, the hidden city enclosed in the mountains on the Jordan-Israel border that you can only get in by horseback or camelback, that was literally built into the walls of the canyon. And the fascinating thing is that by that time, we had the first culture that didn't produce anything, but just moved it in an amazing way. Throughput was their business. We've never found any spices at Petra, and yet we know from historic records that it was one of the highest volume spice trade hubs, like a food hub today, that has ever existed, and yet archaeologists cannot find spices there, A, because they're so perishable. The same thing is true with their ports on the Red Sea, but B, because they were being moved so efficiently in and out of the ports and the hidden hideaways that we've just never discovered any Nabataean spices. And yet Herod the Great, who reputedly condoned the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth, was a Nabataean and an Idumean, the cultures that had that spice route. He was from that legacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary Nabataean, as the author of Come and Camels and Caravans, and, you know, as the fruit of that, those people, you look at that spice trade and you're amazed at what we can learn from what happened then. What lessons can you put on the table from the spice trade today? Have things changed?
I think that the present state of globalization, that thinks it's new and is kind of full of itself, doesn't understand its own history. And I think it's a history that was perhaps on the right track for a while, and then embodied all of the things that have gone wrong in the world. So we used to have virtuous fair trade between different regions of the world, and certainly all of us have drunk fair trade coffee and had other fair trade products, so there's a resurgence of interest in that. But at some point, it became more about the middlemen and an elite capturing control of entire routes and rising above even nations and religions, so that some of these people switched religions at the drop of a hat, or manipulated popes and rabbis and kings and queens by their economic power over them. Converso, a woman born Jewish that then had to abandon, her family had to abandon explicit participation in Jewish rituals to survive, then became resentful and basically controlled all of Europe's spice trades and set up embargoes against.
Gary, we're out of time, but what a great story. Coming, Camels and Caravans, a look at a spice trade of the world. And thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.